Okay. All right. Welcome, dear souls, to this very special edition of the Way of the Yogi podcast. It is Wednesday, July 27th, 2011. I'm Zanna Harris.
And I'm Deborah Barclay.
And together we produce this podcast as an act of devotion to the practice and philosophies of yoga and as an act of service to the yoga community. As I said before, this is an extraordinary segment of our podcast, as we are blessed to have with us a very special guest and some new voices, minds, and hearts accompanying us on our journey through the sutras. I'd just like to briefly go around the circle and have everyone introduce themselves.
Pa,
Andy,
Percy,
Katie,
I'm Laura,
Sandy,
Paul,
Diana,
and James.
Welcome, everyone. I would especially like to thank Paul Millich for making us welcome to meet here at Lucille Street Bhakti House and for making our meeting today with our guest possible. So without further ado, I would like to introduce James Bogue, who is here from Mysore, India, where he studies Sanskrit at university and teaches courses on the sutras and the Bhagavad Gita to yoga students in Mysore. And from what I've seen, James has been tirelessly and selflessly giving of his time and wealth of knowledge to any and all who seek it. And I feel fortunate indeed to have this opportunity to know him. And once you have heard James speak, I think you'll feel the same. And with that, I'll turn it over to James.
Okay, thank you, Zanna, for such a gracious introduction, but I hope we'll be able to live up to it. So I met Zanna the other day and she explained that you've been going through the sutras for some time now and you've been working particularly on the opening section. So there are two possibilities for how we proceed today. So I'll leave it up to the group to decide. We're going to work in two segments, each I guess of about 50 minutes now, yeah? Mm-hmm. And so Zanna mentioned that you might like to recite the sutras or hear the sutras recited, or we could recite it together. Now if we'd like to do that, it's probably going to be helpful that everybody at least can see one between two, maybe, a text to recite after, like if we do it call and response. There's an extra copy up here.
I don't know if this one has the...
Or we can just focus more on looking through the verses and interpreting.
Do we have enough Sanskrit, enough sutras to go around?
I think we do.
I think we do. You guys can have this one.
Yeah, I think we do. Okay.
So, would you like to do that, to recite the first part of what you've been doing?
I'm fine with that.
I think it would be awesome.
Yeah.
So I have a slight preference of picking some of the key ones mm-hmm. and hearing more of your interpretation, but I'll be with you a long time, so I'll get what you
need. Oh, one thing, because you've gone up to the 17th or the 20th.
We've gone up to the 16th, right, and then we're getting ready to work through 17, 18, 19,
okay.
20.
So maybe one way we could do it is, should I just recite it once quickly, and then...
That would be beautiful. Yeah.
And then,
Go through them.
Then you have it, because it's being recorded. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I'll start with an invocation to Patanjali, and then I'll just recite through the first 20. Okay. Let's start with Om together.
Jeshtarajam brahmana brahmanaspata anashinvannutibhissirasadhanam Om gam tatpurushaya vitmahi vakratundaya dhimahi tannorantiv prachurayate Om gam ikarantaya vitmahi vakratundaya dhimahi Tanno randhiv prachurayate Om ganganapataye namah Om ganganapataye namah Ganapataye Namah. Om Shri Maha Ganapataye Namah. Om Vande Guru Nam Charanaravinde. Sandarshita Svatma Sukhava Bodhi. Nishreyase Jangarika Yamani. Samsara hara hara moha shantyai abahu purushakaram shankha chakra sitharinam sahasra shirasam shvetam pranamami patanjalim yogena chittasya parena vacham maram sharirasya cha vairyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Om Atha Shri Patanjala Yoga Darshanam Atha Yoganushasanam Yogaschitta Vritti Nirodha Tadadrashtu Svarupe Vasthanam Vritti Sarupyamitaratra Vrittayah Panjatayah Krishta Krishta Pramana Viparyaya Vikalpa Nidra Smritayah Pratyakshanumanagamah Pramanani Viparyayo Mityajnanamatadrupa Pratishtam Shaptajnanupati Vastushunyo Vikalpah Abhava pratyaya rambana vrittir nidra anubhuta vishaya sampramosha smritihi abhyasa vairagya abhyam tannirotaha tatrastito yatno abhyasaha satu dirka kara nairantarya satkara sevito dhritabhumihi Trishtanushravika Vishaya Vitrishnasya Vashikara Sangya Vairagyam Tatparam Purushakyatir Gunavai Trishnyam Vitarka Vicharananda Smitarupanugamat Sampragnyataha Virama Pratyabhyasa Purva Sanskara Sheshonyaha Bhava pratyayo videha prakritirayanam Shraddha virya smriti samari prajna purvaka itaresham Tivra samveganam asannah Mridu madhyari matratva tatopi visheshah Ishvara pranidhanadva Klesha karma vipakasha yaira paramrishtav purusha vishesha ishwaraha Tatra niratishayam saravagnya bijam Sa esha purvesham api guruh karenana vachedat Tasya vachakav pranavahan tajjapastadartha bhavanam Tataf pratyakchetanadhikamo pyantaraya bhavashcham Vyaristhyana sanshaya pramararasya virati bhranti darshana labdha bhumi katvana vasti tatvani chitta vikshepasthentaraya Dukkha daurmanasyangami jayatva shvasa prashvasa vikshepa sahabhuvaham Tat pratishedhartamika tatvabhyasaham Maitri karuna murito pekshanam Sukha dukkha punya punya vishayanam Bhavanatash chitta prasadanam Prachardhana vidharana bhyamva pranasyam Vishayavativa pravrittirutpanna manasastiti nipandini Ishokava jyotishmati Vitaraga vishayamva chittam Svapna nidra jnana rambanamva Yatabhimata dhyanadva Paramanu Paramamahatvan Tosya Vashikarahan Kshina Vrittir Abhijatasyeva Manir Grahitri Grahana Graheshu Tatstatadanjanata Samapattihim Tatra Shabdharta Jnana Vikalpai Sankirna Savitarka Samapattihim Smriti parishuttau svarupa shunye varta matra nirvasa nirvitarka etayeva savichara nirvichara cha sukshma vishaya vyakyata sukshma vishayatvam charinga paryavasanam taeva sabija samarihi Nirvichara Vaisharadhye Jyatma Prasaraha Vitambara Tatra Prajna Shrutanumana Prajyabhya Manya Vishaya Visheshara Tattvat Tadjas Sanskaronya Sanskara Pratibandhi Tasyapi Nirode Sarva Niroda Nirbijas Samarihi Iti Shri Patanjara Yoga Darshani Pratamah Padaha Samadhi Pada Nama Sampurnaha. So that was the whole of the first chapter.
Wow.
So the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras, as we find in any yoga text, the welcome Salah, just join us. The master, at the beginning, presents the whole teaching in essence. And as they present the whole teaching in essence, they also provide, as it were, the master key to unlock all of the subsequent elaboration. So with any yoga text, we always have to bear that in mind, that the key idea is given at the start, and that provides the overall framing context for the development that follows. And what is the context for the Yoga Sutras? What is the governing idea? Patanjali tells us right at the beginning. He says, Atta Yoga Anushasanam. Now I'm going to tell you about yoga. I'm going to give a presentation of yoga. Yogaha Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Yoga is that state, is that condition, in which the Chitta Vritti are Nirodaha. So Nirod means subsided or fallen away or they've stopped. What has stopped? The whirlings of the mind. Vrit means to turn, and Chitta is the sphere of mental activities. And what's the consequence of that? Tada drashtuhu svarupe avastanam. Then the conscious principle, the seer, is revealed, established in its true form, in its essential nature. So Patanjali tells us that when everything settles down and our identification with those constant comings and goings that we take in through the senses into the mental sphere, when that ceases, and everything settles down, our essential nature is revealed. And this is the state of yoga, also known as samadhi. Mm-hmm. So yoga, Vyasa in his commentary says that, yes, this yoga comes from a Sanskrit root, yuj, which has two related meanings. One, to join, and the other, to contemplate in a meditative way, to meditate. So the idea is that when we practice yogic meditation, we facilitate the reunion or the recognition of our essential self, of our true nature. We reveal, as it were, what we really are. So instead of being identified with this limited body, mind and ego, and instead of feeling so influenced by the externals, we facilitate or we promote a state of awareness in which we recognize that really we are completely whole, completely full, and we are consciousness itself. And as conscious beings, we can enjoy and take in all of the comings and goings of the world. But as we become more and more established in that state of fullness, we can do so in a way which is much steadier. And there it is, the whole teaching of yoga. So let us become like the ocean. There's a beautiful verse towards the end of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Apuryamanam palapratishtam. Oh, excuse me. Shouldn't do this when I'm recording, yeah? Apuryamanam aparapratishtam samudramapav pravishanti yadvati tadvat kamayam pravishanti sarve sushantim apnoti nakama kami. So they say that for the established yogi, that established yogi is like the ocean. Samudram apav pravishanti sarve. Just as all rivers and all waters flow into the ocean, and it's brimful and still the ocean, so the established yogi, all objects of desire, all desires come into contact with that yogi's consciousness through the senses, but that yogi is like the ocean, brimful, and the ocean, full in one's essential nature, whether those desires flow in or not. So the ocean, it's full. Whether the rivers are torrenting down in flood, or whether the rivers have run dry, the ocean is still the ocean. And so it is with the established yogis, that we establish ourselves in awareness of that internal fullness, and then we can operate in this wondrous world of constant change with greater discrimination. So if we feel full, we don't need to engage in the external world with a sense of lack, so we're running after this and that. Rather, we're able to navigate it with a sense of steadiness, which is rooted in an internal sensation, an internal experience. And so the external world then becomes a place of opportunity, becomes a place full of gifts, rather than a place where we're trying to find something to answer an internal longing. Where's the only place we can answer an internal longing? Inside, internally. And so yoga teaches us how to do that. A couple of other interesting things at the very beginning of the sutras. The first word of the Yoga Sutras, Atta. What does it mean?
Now,
the last word of the Yoga Sutras is iti, which means that's it. It's like you close a quote with iti. Now, that's it. Now, the very beginning and the very end of a teaching is said to be very important in the Sanskrit tradition. So, now, that's it. And atta begins with a, which is the first letter of the Sanskrit alphabet. We say a, or aum. Yeah, it's the sound, it's the first sound we utter. And so A symbols the very root of the creation and the source of all of the alphabet and all of the vibrations which then issue forth to become manifest in the universe. So A and then Iti. That's it. Where does yoga happen? When does yoga happen? In the here and now. Also this Atta, there's the idea that and now. So one of the ideas of the Yoga Sutras is that, yes, we've pursued the riches of worldly life. We've tasted the sweetness of sensual experience, of the connection of family life and all the rest of it. We've also tasted the sorrow, which is its natural counterpart. And so naturally, and they say this in the Vedic texts, which Yoga Sutras are an interpretation of, is that when we have a human nervous system, it's quite natural that we have this longing for union. We have this longing to return to ourselves. So it's normal that because we exist in nature, which is constantly changing, we feel this attraction towards those wondrous gifts of nature. But after we have tasted them, it's also completely in the normal run of things, that from a place deep within us, we feel this urge, this spark that suggests to us, there must be something more than all this. Rania cherries are quite wondrous. They come and they go. It is wonderful to feel the kiss of the sunshine on one's skin, but then the clouds come. These pleasures of the world, they come and they go. But the richness of experiencing them suggests to me that there must be a source in which all of it exists. And so they say in the Vedas, it's altogether natural that as a human being we have this urge to discover that richness in which all of this coming and going is sourced, from which it all springs forth. And so if we feel an inclination towards the practice of yoga, towards the exploration of the realm of yoga, this is completely natural. So Atta Yoga Anushasanam, we've tried other things, we've tasted the riches of the world, we've investigated different ways to feel happy, and now we're ready to recognize that yes, there is a more reliable means. There is a more rigorously tested means, the school of yoga. Now, interestingly, I don't think the school of yoga is only Indian. The presentation here in Patanjali it comes from this Indian tradition, which at this time in history is one which gives us a very thorough presentation. But if we look at wisdom traditions from around the world, we find so much common ground in their essential teachings. So really all of humanity shares this common quest to return to our divine source. So the Indian tradition has the idea that we are sparks of divinity. Our source is divine. And it is our birthright and our destiny to return to a full awareness of that. And yoga is a very practical and a very thoroughly presented means to help us do it. But when we start to tune into the subtler implications of the yogic teachings, we realize that these teachings have a lot in common with the heart and the core of wisdom teachings from all around the world. So if we are here in the Pacific Northwest of the United States studying Patanjali, some people might think this is rather exotic. But I think that in the native wisdom traditions of this land, there is a lot of things which are very, very close to these teachings. So I think that the Yoga Sutras now is the time for all of us to return to ourselves. It's the only time we ever have, now. And just because it's come from India, the way things are in the world at the moment, we have access to these ancient wisdom traditions in ways that precedent generations didn't have. But if we embrace them, then we recognize that they are guiding us home to what is always lively inside of us once we learn to tune into it. So now, having tried out lots of other things, let us look at this presentation of yoga, says Patanjali. And then at the very beginning he defines yoga, and he says basically yoga is samadhi. It's when everything settles down and it allows us to see more clearly. So one of the images that's used to describe this is that of a lake. So today our talk is at the Bhakti House, South Seattle in Columbia City District. And we are only a 5-minute stroll from Seward Park. Am I pronouncing Seward Park correctly? Yeah. In Seward Park we can access Lake Washington, yes? Yeah? I arrived here a week ago, I've been to the park I think 3 times, and each time I've beheld the lake. And there has been some breeze playing on the surface of the lake. And what is the consequence of this?
Ripples.
There are ripples on the surface of the lake. And what does that mean? Even if that water is very, very clean, very, very clear, how deep will I see? Not so deep because of the ripples. But if I was to chance upon a completely still, sunny day in Columbia City, South Seattle, and I went to Seward Park, what might I see in the surface of the lake? I might see all the way clearly down to the bottom. So similarly is the idea that with the mind, they use this image of a lake. Chitta vritti, when the mind is whirling and it's identified with all these external things, it clouds our vision. It stops us perceiving reality as it is, completely. But when everything settles down, it allows us to see more deeply and to get a glimpse of that stillness and that fullness and that infinite light, that limitless love, which is our essential nature. Tadadrashtu svarupe avasthanam. But when we're not experiencing that, do we experience that all the time? So maybe some people do, but for most of us that's not. It's not always the case that we wake up and we see the world as a shimmering field of unity. And so if that's not the case, why not? So, so at other times, in other places, in other states, there is identification with the vrittisarupyam, with the forms that are associated with these whirlings of the mind. And what are they? Vrittayah panchatayah krishta krishta. So the vritti, vrittayah in the plural, panchatayah, they are fivefold. There are 5 of them. Krishta krishta. They can be krishta or akrishta. What is krishta?
Krishta is,
Do you know the word klesha? Mm-hmm. Klesha is like an obstacle. Yeah, an obstacle, something that gets in the way, something that creates some difficulty. So klishta means they can cause difficulty, they can cause some pain or some impediment or some conflict, or they can get in the way, or they can be aklishta, they can be not a problem at all. So here Patanjali suggests 5 ways in which the mind behaves, or in which the mental sphere operates, or is influenced. Now, he's not saying there are only five ways in which the mind behaves, but he gives us a model which is a workable model. So this is something that we find within the yoga tradition and its sister philosophical school, Sankhya, is that we get models which are very practically workable. They help us understand the wonder of ultimate reality in a workable way. One thing we have to remember when we're discussing yoga and we're using words is that what is yoga? It is a state of union. It is a state of unity. Words and language exist in the realm of duality. So whenever we're talking about yoga, we have to do so with the acknowledgement that we are talking about that which is beyond verbal expression, which is beyond words. And so the linguistic explanations are only an invitation towards the state or the experience of, or the reality of yoga. They're only designed to usher us in that direction. They don't describe it fully, because the real state is beyond duality, and so it's beyond verbal description. And so here, when we get this model of there are five vrittis, there are five ways in which the mind operates, and then creates, as it were, a different type of impression within us that pulls us away from the impression of our essential nature. And he gives these five, it's just a workable model. So what are these five?
True knowledge.
Yeah. Pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa, nidra, and smriti. So pramana, it means the means of knowledge. And viparyaya, yeah, mistaken knowledge. Vikalpa.
Vikalpa is knowledge by verbal.
Yeah, or imaginary things. Imaginary things that are not based on actual perception, but more to do with like sound.
We came up with the thought that that was relative to like television or radio. And
sure, all those influences.
Like
so somebody describes something. So let's go through them. So pramana, it means. So pratyakshanumanagamah pramanani. So this is very important. So the pramanas, in any Indian school of philosophy, right at the beginning, they will establish what are the pramana, what are the means of establishing correct knowledge. And yoga accepts three. Pratyaksha, anumana, and agama. So pratyaksha means direct perception. So I see the box of pencils. I can see it with my own eyes. If I move closer, I can touch and feel them. I can perceive them with my own sense of touch. Mm-hmm. And so direct perception allows me to decide if something is real. Then there is anumana, inference. This is accepted in the school of yoga. Not every school of philosophy accepts the same pramanas, the same means of knowledge, but yoga accepts inference. Where there is smoke, there is fire. So we look towards the mountain and we see smoke. There is fire on the mountain. I know because smoke is universally concomitant with fire. We don't have smoke without fire. So I can be sure, so I can infer from the smoke. But what does anumana come from? It comes from a direct perception of that which is universally concomitant with fire. So anumana, inference, grows out of a kind of indirect direct perception. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I see the pencil, I can see it. If I see smoke, I cannot see the fire, but I know it's there because...
You still have previous experience of it.
Yeah, it's based on a previous experience that these always go together. But I can still directly perceive something, the smoke, which is the assurance that there is actually fire. And then yoga also accepts agama, that which has come. So this means in this context, it means the sacred texts. It means the authority of a reliable source. So in everyday life, for example, I've spent some time around Paul Millage. I think he is an honest gentleman. Yeah. From where I'm sitting, I cannot see, for example, if there is a container of dishwashing liquid above the sink. So I can ask Paul, is there some dishwashing liquid above the sink? How does he know?
He can
see it directly through pratyaksha, through direct perception. And I believe that he is a reliable source, so I can also accept that this is true. Okay? And so in the case of these teachings, Patanjali, Vyasa, in yoga we accept their testimony. We accept their guidance as authoritative, reliable, and worth paying a lot of attention to. So how do we want to understand the Yoga Sutras? We want to understand it like Patanjali understood it. We want to understand it like Vyasa understood it. And so we take their authority and we work with it. Later on, Patanjali will say that when it comes to the experience of ultimate reality, it's only pratyaksha, it's only one's direct perception. But in more broader terms, these three are accepted within the school of yoga. And pramana means, pratyaksha means direct perception. Then, viparyayo, what is viparyaya?
It's false knowledge.
False knowledge. So, let us say, for example, we come into this room later in the day, after the sun has set, and there is this box of pencils, yes, sitting in the middle of the room. And this is a rectangular box, yes? Let's say one of us forgot a small notebook, like a hard-bound, thick notebook. We open the door and we think, oh, there's my notebook, because it's quite dark and we can't really see. We get close, we pick it up, and then the pencils fly all over the room. Because we made a misperception, which was based on, we didn't quite see it exactly as it is. Because that's a gross illustration. But at a subtler level, we can experience this in many ways in day-to-day life. Yeah? We see things slightly differently to how they are. There are many examples which illustrate this, and the classic one that they always use in the text is the snake and the rope. Yeah. Then we have shabda jnana anupati vastu shunya vikalpaha. So vikalpaha, it's that knowledge based on imagination or on sound, on words. So if, let's close our eyes and let's go for a walk. We're going to go down the road. We're going to go into Seward Park. We're going to go on one of those beautiful old walking trails. And we're going to find our way to one of those ancient trees. And we're going to feel the texture of the bark, for example. Now, some of you might have begun to see, even though I wasn't describing it, big trees, yeah? And you feel the texture of the trail underneath your feet, and then the bark that we touch. Did anybody have that type of experience? This is vikalpa doing its thing. The power of the imagination linked to words to create an impression. So it's not based on something that we're actually perceiving right here and right now, but because of our previous experience in the world, and because of the associations of language, we can get an idea. So sometimes we might find ourselves daydreaming. This is vikalpa. Dream is vikalpa. Somebody says something and it triggers us to recall something else. This is vikalpa. Mm-hmm. And this is a way that the mind can travel in. So the mind can be right here. This is a box of pencils. This is a pile of papers. Or that's my notebook in the dark. Yeah. Or you see that, maybe you see, for example, that box of pencils, and maybe when you were at the little school, these you used to have those orange coloured pencils, and then you start remembering the teacher who taught you to write joined up letters, for example. Then you're in vikalpa. And so that we can see these things are not isolated. There is often overlap between them. Yeah. And then after vikalpaha, we have nidra, abhava pratyaya alambana vrittir nidra. So alambana means support. So sleep, it's that state of experience in the mind which doesn't have an objective substrate. So when we seeing the pencil, we're seeing it through the operating functioning mind. But when we're asleep, it's like there's this kind of void, there's an emptiness. What does it reside on? It's like on nothing. So it's when there's that absence, when there's that void. This is the state of nidra. So sometimes the mind is like empty. It's not focusing on an object. This is nidra. And then smriti, do you know the word smriti?
Memory.
We're all familiar with this one, yeah? So notice in the example that we just had, there's a overlap between vikalpa and smriti, yeah? So we start, that takes us back to a memory. So they all, there's an interplay between them. But the mind, or the mental sphere, is always perceiving things as they are, perceiving things in an incorrect way, creating things, imagining things, in a state of void, or in the realm of memory. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Pretty reasonable, yeah? So it's just like a kind of functional way of describing how the mind operates in different ways. And it gives us these five. And he says they can be klishta, they can cause a problem, or they can be not a problem at all. So what does he mean when they can cause a problem?
What we came up with was like, for instance, something that is klishta or eklishta, painful or non-painful, it can go either way. Like when you're at a big, huge Thanksgiving dinner, remember we came up with that one? And in the moment, eating all that food is so pleasurable, but then when you get on the scale, like a few days later, there's the pain, or your stomach is hurting later, a couple hours later. Uh-huh. So something that can seem painful in the pleasurable in the moment can turn out to actually be very painful later. And vice versa, if you have to study for a test, you know, it's the last thing you want to do. But then when you pass the test and you're able to go to university subsequently, then it turns out to be something that has brought you pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these five, the context here, what is the context? Is samadhi. Yeah? So these five, they can contribute towards or they cannot impede our experience of samadhi, or they can. So if we have, for example, false knowledge of the pencils, and then we have the experience of picking up that box when we think it's a little notebook and spilling them all around the room. Let's say we're a little child who does that, and somebody says, "Oh, you clumsy thing." And the child grows up thinking that he or she is clumsy when he or she is not. But then sown within their mental reservoir is this idea, "Oh, I am clumsy. I am maladroit, I am not dexterous, I am not skillful." And so it inhibits that person's confidence to really be themselves. This is aklishta, it is impeding their growth to realize their innate glory. But if the person picks it up and nothing happens, it's not a problem. Yeah, misperception is part of life. We rely on the senses. They're not perfect organs. They're miraculous gifts, but they serve wonderful purposes. But it's not like we always see everything exactly as it is. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's almost as though, in the negative sense, that it's becomes a form of judgment or self-judgment by internalizing this thought that I'm clumsy and then not being able to sort of release yourself from that.
Yeah. And then the state, for example, of void, nidra. We need to sleep as human beings. But if we're finding that we're feeling a fog of awareness, it's going to impede our experience of samadhi in the waking state. And then ultimately the yogi wants to experience samadhi in the dream state, in the sleep state as well. So in that instance, for the yogi operating at that level, it could be klishta, it could be a barrier to samadhi if it's impeding that liveliness even in that state of waking, of sleep, of dream or of sleep. Does that
falling asleep during meditation too.
Yeah, there you go. But falling asleep during meditation, it could happen because we need a rest. Yeah. So that's not none of these things are good or bad. Is the idea when he says klishta klishta, it's like they're not good or bad per se. This is just the way it is. This is just the reality of the way that the mental sphere and the human nervous system functions.
Right, but thinking makes it so.
Yeah, like Hamlet says. So the thinking, the associations that we make, like giving that example of it, a seed is sown which makes us identify with limitation, or I am clumsy. No, you are infinite creative potential. So when these seeds are sown which make us identify with limitation, that's when they really become klishta. If they don't, then it's fine. Yeah. So to the yogi in the world, nothing is denied, but it's how we work with the impressions of the world which distinguishes whether it's klishta, a pain or a hindrance, or it's aklishta, it's no bother at all. So what is the means to bring that state where these whirlings of the mind subside and we identify with our essential nature? So the first kind of very specific sutra of direct instruction, the 12th. Abhyasa vairagya abhyam tannirodhaham. So he gives two means, abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa vairagya abhyam tannirodhaham. So by these two, tan, these vrittis, nirodaha. So remember the second sutra? Yogas chitta vritti nirodaha. Yoga is that state where the chitta vritti is nirodaha. How to make that nirodaha come about? How to make that falling away, that settling down come about? Two means, abhyasa and vairagya. What is abhyasa?
Practice.
And what is vairagya? Yeah, vairagya is quite difficult to translate.
Or even do.
Exactly.
But we realize that it's not something that we actually have to do. This is one of the interesting things. We'll come to this in a couple of verses' time.
Ah.
What are some of the other translations you have for vairagya?
Freedom from desires.
Freedom from desire, yeah, desirelessness. Any others?
And detachment, which we already...
Detachment. Yeah. So detachment, in English, there's a sense of, kind of, it doesn't touch you, yeah? But this isn't really what vairagya means, as we'll come to find out. Vairagya means you're fully there, but it doesn't have an effect on you. The nice thing comes, you can enjoy it. The nasty thing comes, you're not knocked off centre by it. The nice thing comes, yes, I'll take it, no need to take it. It's that state, where we feel that state of fullness. So it's not like we need anything from the external realm. So what we notice, what we begin to see now, is the way that Patanjali sets forth his argument. So abhyasa vairagya abhyam tan nirodha. He introduces a key idea, abhyasa, another one, vairagya, and what will follow, the definition thereof. So 13 and 14, tatra stithau yatno abhyasaha. So what is abhyasaha? Tatra, of these two, abhyasa and vairagya, stitau yatnaha abhyasaha. Practice is the yatnaha, the harnessing of our energy, the effort to secure stitau, to make things steady. So practice is the effort or the engagement to facilitate, to promote steadiness, stability. Okay? How would you describe the state of yoga?
It's difficult to put into words.
So let's go to some of Patanjali's words. Yeah, later on in the second chapter, when he describes yoga asana, how does he describe yoga asana? Sthira sukham asanam. What does asana mean? It means seat. So the seat of yoga is steady and easy. In other words, it's sustainably steady and easy. Because the only real ease is that which is steady. If you can't maintain it, it's not really easy. You're going to be anxious about it, yeah? And the only real steadiness is that which is also easy. Because if there's an extreme effort in it, it can't be maintained. So the seat of yoga, is one that is steadily easy. And similarly, so is the state of yoga. And what facilitates steady ease? Balance, yeah? So it's a state of balance. So tatra stithau yatno abhyasaha, it's the effort to secure steadiness. Now if you want to find balance, what type of effort is required?
Less efforts.
Yeah, a gradually refining effort. So if we're way out of balance, we might need to do some big heavy duty construction work, yeah? But then, once we get more in balance, it becomes more refined. So the effort to secure steadiness. So basically, yoga, the action of yoga is an appropriate action, is an appropriate effort. There's no wasted effort, yeah? When we go to the Bhagavad Gita, how does Krishna define yoga? Two of the ways he defines it in the second chapter. Samatvam yoga uchyate. Yoga is said to be evenness. And yogaha karmasu kaushalam. Yoga is skillfulness in action. So when we have evenness, steadiness, then our actions can be skillful. Is this true?
Yeah.
If we feel flustered or anxious or angry, can we give our best performance? No. But when we feel steady and easy, then we've got the chance to give our optimal performance, our optimal response to the reality of the current moment, whatever it might be. And similarly with the effort of practice, it must be a judicious one, a discriminating one, one that is governed from a sense of discernment and awareness. So Tatrastitau yatna abhyasa. Yatnaha, it means effort, means putting some effort in. But what type of effort is it? It's the one to secure steadiness. So it's not going to be an unsustainable, extreme effort, which, say if we're out of balance and then we make this extreme effort and now we're out of balance. No. It's like, we just do, of course, there's always going to be this interplay, but we're doing our best to walk, as it were. Andy, how do they describe it in the Upanishads? You said it this morning, to walk the... I used one this morning, but you didn't.
The razor's edge.
They walk the razor's edge, yeah. So it's like they give this image, in the Upanishads of like, it's like, so I, this morning we said like, I sometimes use the example of a tightrope, or a slack line? So it's like a tightrope, but it's a bit harder to balance because it's slacker. So as soon as you lose the center on a slack line, you can feel it, you're going to fall off. But as soon as you get in the middle, maybe when you... Has anybody ever been on a slack line? You have. What's it like when you first get on, Laura?
The first time you get on.
Yeah.
You fly right off.
Fly right off. And then what's it like the first time you feel, for a moment, the balance?
Incredible.
Because you can feel it totally, yeah? You really know you're in the center.
Yeah.
It might be for a split second, but you know. And that's like the state of yoga. The whole system rejoices, revels in it. And then when we come away from that, the system also knows and will tell us. And so as we're practicing, we have to work responsively with receptivity and awareness to just do our best to ensure that our effort is a skillful one, is an appropriate one. And as we practice, we get better at practicing. Yeah? So as we practice yoga, we get more skilled at harnessing our effort in such a way that it supports stability, it supports steadiness. So that's what yoga practice is for. It is the effort to secure steadiness, okay? So it's not the effort to secure what's sometimes in Northern American yoga publications they describe as yoga butt, or the yogic abs, or something that you see on some of these publications. Nor is it the effort to secure, this or that worldly result.
Or that perfect posture.
Or that, the execution of, let's think of a difficult posture. What's
Hanumanasana.
No, yeah. Hanumanasana. It's not that effort. Not that effort at all. That effort could be part of it. If we do that with discrimination and steadiness and working skillfully to find that balance, then for some people that could be a very potent and a very effective means to pursue that steadiness. But it never has anything to do with an external appearance. It's always to do with an internal steady state of not just the mind, but the body, the senses, the whole system.
How we live our lives.
Yes, definitely. Every aspect of our lives.
So it's really easy, like in a physical sense, to determine when you're off balance.
Yes.
But when you're talking about an emotional or a spiritual sense, there's no physical... there are some physical manifestations, but it's harder to determine what that is.
Except sometimes I think I can...
Sorry?
Do you ever feel it in your gut?
There are some manifestations, I guess.
When you're not coming from your own truth, do you ever feel that, like...
So this,
like deep whisper.
This idea of the slack line, yeah? When we're on a slack line, as soon as we're off balance, we feel it. There's no running away, there's no hiding it. However, I'm also of the persuasion that any time in life when we do something that's not in our own highest interest, really deep down we know. The problem, or the difficulty, or the impediment, the klishta, the thing that gets in the way, is that these mental whirlings have been conditioned by so many other social factors. And one of the consequences of our societal upbringing in the current context is that we are trained to subdue our innate wisdom. Little kids, eat your dinner, eat it all. Don't leave any, don't let any go to waste. Children are force-fed. Sometimes the child is starving. Wait until your dinner time. And so this gloriously... And do you see obese animals that live in the wild.
Yeah. Not in the wild.
No. Yeah, maybe if they have. You know. But we have all the all the intelligence we have to, for example, feed ourselves with great skill. It's there inside our DNA. Within our DNA, there is all the knowledge we need to breathe properly. But many people these days, when they start doing yoga, there is that, I didn't know how to breathe before. But we do know how to breathe. It's encoded in our DNA. The pulsation, the heartbeat, the very essence of material existence. And so, one of the things that's happened is that we've been taught, in past lives perhaps, as well as in this one, habits which pull us away from our innate intelligence. So what the mechanisms of yoga do is they let everything settle down so we find the pathway back to that deep, that innate realm of infinite creative potential and infinite intelligence, which is the light of consciousness and is our essential self. So as we tune into that more and more, that begins to the influence of that and the impression of that begins to percolate back up, to bubble back up towards the surface and become more lively in our senses, in the different layers of our mind, and then to be able to help us interact with the world more skillfully, with more of our innate intuitive wisdom at our beck and call, as it were. But without a doubt, societal conditioning suppresses a lot of that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we're afraid to respond. We know we should respond, but we're afraid to respond because we don't have faith in our response to that need that we know inside.
Does that sound, does that ring a bell? Does everybody recognize that? Sometimes, I know, but, oh no, I shouldn't, I mustn't speak up now.
Well, we just don't want to, we're just plain afraid to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Yeah.
Because we're afraid we'll be judged for it.
Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen. We're afraid of the unknown of reacting to it. Mm-hmm. We know what the fear is going to bring us. We've reacted to that already. But we're afraid to listen to ourselves. You know.
So as you suggest, it's like, it's not easy. It's not so, it's not so instantly visible as it is with the physical thing.
Like it's like practicing a posture that you couldn't get when you first started, asana. Like you do it again and again and again, and then bam, you're hitting it almost every time you do the posture, and you deepen that posture. It's the same thing.
So we just tune in more and more subtly to that intuitive wisdom. And as we do it, we just keep doing our best. And as we keep doing our best gets better. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Do we need to pause halfway now?
Yeah, I think we can pause here.
Yeah.
So, did you cut it off or anything?
Not yet.
All right, so that'll conclude the first half of our segment today. Second half, momentarily. Thank you.